Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's event with the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen. Let me first recognise one of my board members, David Gonski, as well as the Shadow Minister for Trade and Investment, Jason Clare, Greg Medcraft, one of our corporate members, and other friends of the Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a stark moment for those of us who believe in open economies and free societies. Since the end of the Second World War, the liberal international order has set the conditions for peace and prosperity for countries such as Australia. But there are troubling developments afoot. Every day, the liberal international order becomes less liberal, less international, and less orderly. In a number of important countries around the world, the appeal of populism and nativism is growing. In Washington, the leader of the free world is not particularly attracted to the free world, and is not providing the kind of leadership we're accustomed to getting from Washington. Now, one of the pillars of that order is free trade. On his first day in office, President Trump signed an executive order withdrawing the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, thereby damaging America's economic prospects and undercutting its position in Asia. Mr. Trump has demolished the domestic case for free trade in the United States. The Republican Party, previously a party of free traders, has lost its compass. But of course, it's not just Mr. Trump and the GOP. The two leading candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, both opposed the TPP. This is a long way from the Democratic Party of the 1990s, which supported President Bill Clinton as he signed NAFTA and worked towards removing trade barriers through APEC. Across the Atlantic, the historic project to unite the European continent looks shaky. An allergy to international flows of people and trade caused the British people to act against their own economic interests by voting to leave the European Union. And of course, for some years, the multilateral trading regime has been comatose. So this is, a stark moment for those of us who believe in open economies and free societies. And therefore, it's a good time to hear from one of the leading market-oriented Labor figures in Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Bowen was first elected to the House of Representatives in 2004 for the Division of Prospect, which later became the Division of McMahon. During the Rudd and Gillard governments, he served as Assistant Treasurer, Minister for Financial Services, Minister for Human Services, Minister for Immigration, and briefly Treasurer. I've known Chris since we were students at university. Since then, he's become one of the outstanding politicians of his generation. Like many of the best politicians he reads, not long ago I ran into Chris on a plane. Many of the best politicians, but not all of them, I might say. I ran into Chris on a plane from Canberra to Sydney. At the end of a few days in Canberra, I wouldn't begrudge someone picking up some light reading, whether it was Vanity Fair or New Idea, but Chris's head was buried in an issue of Foreign Affairs. I read another story recently that Chris won a citizenship prize in primary school, and with it a $10 book voucher, and he went to Angus and Robertson. Now, for the millennials here, Angus and Robertson used to have actual shops where they sold actual books. He went to Angus and Robertson and he bought Paul Kelly's The Hawk Ascendancy. Chris, that is intense. Chris is also an author in his own right. In 2015, he published a history of Australian treasurers titled The Money Men, Australia's 12 Most Notable Treasurers. And it wasn't just the longest job application ever written. It was an excellent book that was well reviewed and is worth a read. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Honourable Chris Bowen MP to speak on the topic of progress in turbulent times, thoughts on the global economy.
Well, thanks, Michael, and thanks to the Institute for the invitation to be with you today. It's always a pleasure to accept the invitation from the Lowy Institute. Not just because the Lowy Institute has become such an important part of our intellectual infrastructure in our country, and not just because, as Michael said, we've known each other for 25 years or so, but because these are important topics which must be addressed in a national debate. I'm also delighted to be joined today by our Shadow Minister for Trade and Resources, Jason Clare. Now, I've also known Jason for longer than we might care to dwell on. In our case, we grew up together in Western Sydney, so even longer than I've known Michael. Perhaps because of that, we share a very similar world view. And in Jason and I, you'll have a Treasurer and a Trade Minister working very closely together on important matters in our global and domestic economies. We're also Canberra flatmates, which will ensure smooth and efficient communications between us, perhaps over a drink at the end of a long sitting day in our Canberra apartment. Of course, we'll be working closely under Bill's leadership with colleagues like Penny Wong and Jim Chalmers and the entire Cabinet in the Shorten Labor government on the big issues facing our economy and our region. Now, it's easy to be pessimistic about the global economy if you care about a international order, if you believe that trade can lift living standards and support the development of a rules-based liberal international engagement system which has served the world well since the end of World War II. Looking around the world, these beliefs are under constant attack from a nativist populism which has seemingly convinced many with legitimate grievances and concerns that lifting the drawbridge and engaging in greater isolation is the answer to their problems and a way to restore their country to its former glory. And the general uncertainty created by a febrile environment in which the prospects of a trade war between the world's two biggest economies, or perhaps even something more serious, are assessed and considered in serious company, are a cause for pessimism. But I'm more optimistic than that. Yes, many of the developments recently have not been for the better, but I do want to cover a few issues today. Firstly, how we can win the argument for openness and the benefits of openness for many, if not all. Secondly, the state of the debate about trade liberalisation in our region following the demise of the TPP. Thirdly, ambitiously and perhaps courageously, I'll argue it's time to prepare for another attempt at genuine multilateral trade liberalisation through the World Trade Organisation. And finally, I want to make some observations about engagement in our region. Firstly, let me provide some brief views about how we can win the openness argument. We have to win the evidence battle, the passion battle, the fairness and inclusivity battle. While the world understandably concentrates on Trump, Brexit and Le Pen, there are other examples that provide an alternative template. In France, Emmanuel Macron is combining a passion for progressive politics with a belief in openness and trade, and he's showing that such an approach can gain traction. And of course, in Canada, Justin Trudeau's Progressive Liberal Party showed in its massive 2015 electoral win what an optimistic and progressive case can achieve. Let me deal with the evidence battle first. Prior to the global financial crisis, advanced economies around the world, including Australia, had experienced one of the greatest lift in living standards in world history. GDP per capita in purchasing power parity terms grew by two-thirds for advanced economies between 1995 and 2007, and it's not just in advanced nations. The proportion of the global population classified as living in poverty fell from around 30% in the mid-1990s to 10% in recent years. It's incontrovertible that trade played a central role in these advances. As the OECD has pointed out, East Asia and the Pacific, where virtually all countries have embraced outward-looking development strategies, trade intensity and GDP have grown hand in hand. In the 1990s, per capita real income grew by more than three times as fast for developing countries that lowered trade barriers than for other developing countries. And according to the World Bank, extreme poverty has declined faster in East Asia and the Pacific than in any other region, falling from 80% in 1981 to 4% in 2015. But not only has trade been important for our economic success over the last quarter of a century, the global slowdown in trade has in part been responsible for the anemic recovery from the GFC. In fact, even in the United States, where unemployment has fallen to around 5%, it's experienced the slowest recovery from an economic downturn since World War II. And it's not just in the United States. Unemployment remains stubbornly high in many advanced economies, mired in anemic growth. The lessons of history here are important. During and after the global financial crisis and the subsequent global recession, we liked to congratulate ourselves that we'd avoided the protectionist response that accompanied the Great Depression. By avoiding tariffs like those imposed under the infamous Smoot-Hawley Act of 1930, we avoided the downward spiral of growth and deepening depression. But the modern reality is more complex than that. A decade before the GFC, international trade grew at roughly twice the rate of economic growth. Since then, it's barely kept pace. The WTO recently predicted that for the first time in 15 years, international trade will grow more slowly than global output in 2016. And while global growth and investment are weak, rising protectionism is increasingly cited as one of the reasons for this slowdown. As a recent Lowy G20 paper pointed out, as of last year, less than a quarter of the 1,583 trade restrictive measures introduced by G20 nations since 2009 have been eliminated, and indeed such measures have continued to accumulate. Looked at another way, the WTO points out that in 2010 there were 464 trade restricting measures in place, but by the middle of last year this number had grown to 2,127. This comes at a cost. As the OECD analysis shows, each dollar of increased border protection leads to a drop of GDP of 66 cents. Increasingly, of course, the production of goods now occurs across multiple borders, making the need to resist increased protectionism even more compelling than it has been in the past. Recent OECD data suggests that around 75% of global trade is now comprised of intermediate imports and capital goods and services. Again, as the OECD has stated, imposing protectionist measures on imports is the trade policy equivalent of shooting yourself in the foot, causing costs of production to rise and damaging competitiveness for exporting firms. The case is clear. Open trade has been a source of increasing prosperity. We need to present the evidence clearly. These raw facts don't mean that the argument's been won. Far from it. For example, in 2015, the Pew Research Center found that about two-thirds of Americans say that growing trade and business ties between the US and other nations is good for the economy. Yet only one in five Americans thinks that trade with other countries creates jobs. And I suspect the views in Australia would be fairly similar, particularly in some regions. As I'll deal with in a few moments, trade and economic dislocation generally does have losers, and no lecture about the greater good will or should cut the mustard with these people. Governments have to listen to concerns that this dislocation is having, particularly in parts of our economy that are not doing as well as our big cities. But the onus is on leaders to do better in communicating the benefits of trade and what trade delivers. And it's not just about dry facts. Secondly, to the passion battle. Facts are essential. We all understand them. But they are not enough. Proponents of nativist populism, whether they are British, American or Australian, have access to and use effectively powerful emotions of returning to a nostalgic past, where all was good and patriotism ruled together with traditional values. We need to passionately expound the case of openness as a virtue. The opening of the Chinese economy, for example, to more market international forces has driven the biggest lift of people out of poverty in human history. Liberalisation of trade through the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and then the WTO saw a trade increase fourfold between 1970 and 2008, lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in China, India and many other countries. This should be celebrated. For Australia, the opening of our economy has turned aspirations into reality, raising living standards for many who previously would have been consigned to jobs with a limited future. The facts are not just on the side of openness, but virtue is as well. We should tell this story loudly and proudly. Again, I see opportunities and cause for optimism in the current debate. Around the world, people are saying they want to debate values. They don't want election campaigns to be dry debates between political insiders as to who is the more competent technocrat. They want a contest of values, of ideas. As far as we're concerned, they're more than happy to oblige. Thirdly, the fairness battle. I think I've made clear in my speech today that I'm a supporter of an open economy and an outward-looking nation. But let's not kid ourselves that the current arrangements work well for everyone. In the Australian context, not only facing the global forces of a rapid technological disruption and subdued world economy, there's a separate and more unique transition underway as mining investment continues to fall dramatically. It's particularly pronounced in many of our regions. You only have to look at the annual average employment data for New South Wales and Queensland over the last 12 months to get a glimpse of this city-regional divide. In Sydney's eastern suburbs, for example, unemployment is a very low 3.1%. But in places like New England and northwest New South Wales, unemployment is 7.7%. A similar pattern exists in Queensland. The unemployment rate in inner-city Brisbane sits at 3.5%. But in Cairns, the unemployment rate is closer to 8%, while in outback Queensland, unemployment sits at 11.6%, up from around 4% just 18 months ago. And while the recent bounce back in GDP was anticipated and welcome, it continues to mask ongoing weakness. Wages growth in Australia continues to deteriorate and is now running at an annual rate of just 1.8% in the private sector, the lowest rate in a generation. Our unemployment rate is higher than it was during the GFC, and there are now 56,000 fewer full-time jobs in Australia than there were a year ago, together with elevated underemployment. This is not to mention the fact that households around Australia have been forced to take on record amounts of debt to live out the dream of buying a home, the same dream that their parents were able to achieve with greater ease a few decades ago. We can't expect people to be upset about the attacks on a globalised economy when they don't feel they're benefiting from that globalised economy. Here at home, quite the contrary. As the OECD's noted, the differences in the pace of income growth across household groups have particularly been pronounced in some English-speaking countries. In the UK, those who voted to leave Europe were overwhelmingly those for whom the economy is no longer working. From the mid-1980s to the late 2000s, household incomes in the top decile in the UK grew by 2.5 times the rate of the bottom decile. The Economist magazine recently asked the question as to what proponents of openness should do in the face of this inequality. As you know, The Economist is no journal of the radical left, but it answered its own question in these terms, and I quote, "The most important thing to do is devise policies that spread the benefits of globalisation more widely." Another one of my favourite magazines, The New Statesman, recently put it this way. Again, I quote, "The truth is that for a while now, growth has failed to deliver its moral dividend alongside its economic one because the increased prosperity has not been shared fairly." This is part of the reason why Labor's agenda is so important for Australia, protecting Australia's low and middle income families from harsh cuts to family payments, ensuring that our temporary skilled migration system does what it's intended to do and simply fill genuine gaps in employment, focusing on schools and vocational education improvements so Australians know their government will assist them in lifting their ability to contribute and to compete. And at a time when profit growth is at record highs and wages growth is at record lows, protecting people who work on weekends from an unprecedented absolute pay cut. As a pro-growth progressive, I think there are lots of good reasons to care about income inequality, social mobility and inclusiveness. But even if I didn't care about these things from a moral or progressive point of view, I would care about them from the vantage point of making it easier to defend globalisation and an open economy. The more people feel they benefit from our economy, the more they will embrace openness and a system which has allowed a small economy like Australia to prosper. I'd now like to turn to a few specific observations about the state of free trade. Now, one would think by reading headlines that freer trade in our region is now a bit of a pipe dream. The TPP is dead. No one in Australia killed it. A rather high-profile American did. But there's no point pretending it's alive or that it's merely pining for the fjords. The benefits of the TPP would not have been as great for Australia as some people make out. We already have free trade agreements with most of the TPP members, so progress to be made through the TPP was marginal. Material, real, but marginal. But with the TPP effectively dead, it's likely that the short term, that the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, initiated by ASEAN nations, will take centre stage. RCEP's a regional agreement with the ASEAN member states and those countries that have existing FTAs with ASEAN, Australia, China, India, Japan, the Republic of Korea, and New Zealand. The 16 RCEP participating countries account for more than 3.5 billion people, more than 4 times the population covered in the TPP, around 30% of global GDP, and 25% of world exports. Importantly for Australia, RCEP includes 9 out of Australia's top 13 trading partners and 70% of Australia's trade in goods and services. So concluding a deal here could deliver large benefits. Given some RCEP countries were not in the TPP have relatively high barriers to trade, it's possible that any incremental gains here have the potential to deliver larger gains than the TPP. Now, of course, RCEP itself should not be seen as the end goal. RCEP provides a pathway to broader liberalisation within APEC. APEC's often a forgotten body when it comes to trade, but it's been quietly achieving real results on the trading front. APEC is, of course, a proud achievement of my side of politics, and APEC cannot be overlooked while other groupings such as the G20 attract all the attention. In 2012, APEC agreed to slash tariffs on 54 environmental goods to no more than 5%, boosting trade and improving access to the tools needed to fight climate change. This was the first multilateral tariff-cutting arrangement in 20 years, which helped lower the cost of environmental goods like solar panels, wind turbines, and air pollution control equipment. This comes on the back of APEC reducing average tariffs in our region from 17% to less than 6% since 1989. Liberalisation through RCEP has the potential to crowd in other Asia-Pacific economies over time, which will reinvigorate trade discussions towards a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific, or FTAP, as it's commonly known. Further liberalising trade and investment in the APEC area is particularly important given Australia's place in the region, and also given APEC, of course, brings together the US and China. Now, the one thing we shouldn't be doing is spending all our energy trying to resuscitate or advocate deals like the TPP, which are not going anywhere. Instead, Australia should be actively participating in the regional discussion about what's next when it comes to regional freer trade. I'd also like to turn to another matter for which I have some optimism, or at least a little bit of hope. Maybe, just maybe, the decline in the popularity of bilateral free trade agreements will lead to an international reconsideration of the benefits of genuine trade reform through the WTO. This is really hard, but the payoff is big. There's been a false debate in recent years, both in Australia and internationally. Apparently, you're pro-trade if you're pro-free trade agreement. But bilateral free trade agreements are a third best outcome after genuine multilateral reform through the WTO as the best outcome, and regional or plurilateral trade agreements as the second best. Bilateral free trade agreements have only become fashionable as the world appeared to have given up any hope of meaningful multilateral reform, frustrated by repeated failed attempts. But free trade agreements have eaten up the resources of trade negotiators and consumed the political bandwidth in Australia and elsewhere. These deals take up considerable energy of the body politic and in the process take the focus of genuine multilateral reform. As the Productivity Commission has consistently argued, the benefits of trade liberalisation are greatest if the liberalisation is undertaken on a multilateral basis. It's no coincidence that the prosperity achieved since the Second World War has coincided with great progress in multilateral trade liberalisation. Going back as far as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, an international code of tariff and trade rules that was signed by 23 countries in 1947. Of course, by the end of the 1970s, more than 100 countries had joined. GATT sponsored several rounds of multilateral trade negotiations, culminating in the Uruguay round in the 1990s. Again, as the WTO notes, the Uruguay round involved 123 countries covering almost all trade, from toothbrushes to pleasure boats, from banking to telecommunications, and was simply the largest trade negotiation ever and probably the largest negotiation of any kind in history. By lowering tariffs and liberalising capital markets, increased competition drove unparalleled increases in living standards around the world. Many factors, of course, contributed to this remarkable expansion of trade, but the fact that it coincided with a significant reduction in trade barriers through genuine multilateral reform is inescapable. Conversely, bilateral arrangements can increase the complexity and business costs of international trade while diverting trade from some countries to others. As the head of the Productivity Commission, Peter Harris, has said, it's red tape and it's growing at a very healthy rate. Now, it's not to say that the perfect should be the enemy of the good. The recent incremental approach through multilateralism is a case in point. This breakthrough reform involves countries coming together to harvest the areas of long-standing Doha round of multilateral trade negotiations of which there's a real chance of agreement. This more practical, incremental approach began taking shape a few years ago and is really now starting to bear fruit, particularly in relation to the trade facilitation, agriculture and services. In fact, 22nd of February, just a few weeks ago, was an important occasion with the entry into force of the Trade Facilitation Agreement, with the 110th country ratification now received. This agreement will radically cut administrative burdens and inefficient customs procedures involved in trade. Fully implemented, the Trade Facilitation Agreement has the potential to reduce costs by more than 14% and increase global exports by up to $1 trillion. This will add more than 0.5% a year to world GDP growth, just what our economy needs. And from Labor's point of view, we're proud that Labor's Trade Minister Craig Emerson played an important role in negotiations which brought this about. Craig Emerson and Australia realised that the Doha Round's goal of a single undertaking, that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, is beyond reach. So Craig and Australia advocated for and led a new pathways approach to finding consensus in different areas of trade, instead of focusing on the entire Doha Round. This is in keeping with Australia's well-deserved reputation as an honest broker in multilateral trade negotiations. Labor believes that Australia can play an important role again in progressing the case for multilateral reform. We don't overstate that role. We're a middle-sized economy, and the task is tough. But the task also seemed daunting when Australia formed the Cairns Group 30 years ago. The Cairns Group brought together 19 agricultural exporting developed and developing countries, which account for 25% of the world's agricultural exports, and lobbied for a sensible outcome on agriculture in the Uruguay Round. Without the Cairns Group, the Uruguay Round may not have reached successful conclusion, or, if it did, the outcome for agricultural countries may not have been as good as it was. The incremental approach advocated by Australia and like-minded countries also led the WTO agreement reached in Nairobi in December 2015 to eliminate agricultural export subsidies that had so grievously damaged farmers in Australia and other Cairns Group countries during the 1980s. And the Trade and Services Agreement, jointly led by the US and EU, with Australia playing a key role, is also making good progress. This is an agreement which will cover 70% of the total global services in trade, including areas like financial services, telecommunications, and e-commerce and professional services. The services sector employs 4 out of 5 of every people in Australia, and so the potential job creation benefit for an agreement like this is pretty clear. While negotiations for trade and services agreement are outside the auspices of the WTO, there is potential for this agreement to be multilateralised within the WTO at some point in the future. We should be continuing to work with like-minded countries to prepare the ground for when international political circumstances allow multilateral negotiations to take off again. This might not be for a few years, but we can lay the groundwork now with other countries that see the benefits of genuine multilateral reform. A genuine multilateral approach maximises the gains from trade and avoids the damage of trade being diverted from low-cost to higher-cost countries. Multilateral trade, based on the Most Favoured Nation clause, where that is offered, or what is offered to one country has to be offered to all, is the most comprehensive and rewarding approach to trade liberalisation. And while this might have been a bit easier to achieve last century, it's not now. Variance amongst a number of WTO members in terms of interest and priorities has made negotiations harder to manage and slower to complete. In 1956, there were just 26 countries in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. In 1994, this had grown to 128. There are now 164 members of the WTO. This means that each of those 164 members effectively has the power of veto in the Doha Round. Each of these countries, regardless of their size, can hold the negotiating table to ransom. One country disagrees and progress stalls. Multilateral reform will continue to be the first best option. That's why thought should be put into whether genuine multilateral agreements like Doha should be held to ransom by the positions of one or two member countries seeking to block them. This may sound radical, but a more pragmatic approach might be desirable, such that when WTO agreements achieve a critical mass or a coalition of the willing, they can still move forward. Such plurilateral agreements are already provided for under WTO rules. This, of course, is ultimately a matter for the WTO and further deliberation, but it is worth exploring by member countries, including Australia. Opening the doors to new trade pathways through agreements is important, but of course it's not enough, which brings me to my final set of observations about economic engagement in our region. Global uncertainty makes economic engagement with our region, particularly Southeast Asia, more important and urgent than ever. Frankly, in Australia, we often pay the Asian century more lip service than serious effort and reform. If Australia manages to access just 1% of the emerging middle class market in Asia, it will be the equivalent of accessing 6 cities the size of Sydney. Take Indonesia as one example. The growing Indonesian middle class and the fact that Indonesia is likely to be in the world's 5 largest economies by 2050 means that our economy will benefit from much closer economic engagement with this growing economic power, which is such a near neighbour. It would be negligent if we didn't forge closer economic engagement with such a large, rapidly growing economy so close to us. Just as Australia and Indonesia's leaders have had a formalised leaders' dialogue since 2010, and our foreign and defence ministers have had a 2+2 dialogue since 2012, I propose that Australia and Indonesia formalise annual meetings between our finance and trade ministers in an economic and investment 2+2. This is something that Jason and I would formally propose to our Indonesian friends early in a shortened government. One of the things that annoys me about policies which promote Asian engagement is the tendency for incoming governments to throw out the work of previous governments just because it wasn't initiated by the incumbents. Policies in this space take time to mature and pay off, and we can't afford short-termism and opportunism. Labor's Australia in the Asian Century White Paper was a very important blueprint, but it remains archived and largely unimplemented. This was a report which clearly laid out pathways to reform, to grow people-to-people links in our region, and to ensure that we grasp the many opportunities that lie ahead. Boardrooms in Australia still remain drastically underrepresented when it comes to having an understanding of Asia. An objective of the White Paper was that one-third of board members of Australia's top 200 publicly listed companies and Commonwealth bodies, including companies, authorities and agencies, will have deep experience in and knowledge of Asia. But years later, the so-called bamboo ceiling in Australia remains in place. A recent report showed that 17% of working Australians identify themselves as having an Asian cultural background. But out of Australia's top 200 companies, just 1.9% of executive managers and 4.1% of directors have Asian cultural origins. It's not just about the boardroom, it's also about the classroom. I believe that more young people learning Asian languages and developing an interest in our closest neighbours is an important national imperative for Australia. As I previously said, politicians shouldn't lecture young people about doing something about this if we're not prepared to do so ourselves. In our shadow ministry, our shadow foreign affairs minister, Penny Wong, speaks some Bahasa Malay. 3 years ago, I decided it would be hypocritical to wax lyrical about the need for us to be more Asia literate unless I was prepared to do something about it myself, and so enrolled myself in a Diploma of Modern Languages in Bahasa Indonesia. My modest contribution to improving Asian language literacy in Australia. All going to plan, I'll finish this year, and I suppose I'll then be an official Indonesian speaker, although with a highly questionable and heavy Australian accent. My shadow ministerial colleagues, Stephen Jones and Matt Thistlewaite, are enrolled in the same diploma, Stephen in Indonesian and Matt in Mandarin, and will join our colleague, the member for Solomon, Luke Gosling, who's already fluent in Bahasa Indonesia, and Jenny Macklin, who speaks Japanese. Asian literacy in our federal caucus is probably at an historic high point, but as a nation we have so much more to do, an issue we'll tackle in government. So let me end where I began. It's a confusing, confronting time in the global economic environment. While the real global economy is so much better than that confronted in 2008 and 9, we're still dealing very much with the dislocation caused by the Great Recession and the anemic recovery which has followed. But this is a time for cool heads, for a values-based approach, which looks to the long game. It's a time which calls for governments to listen to people's concerns about those left behind and provide concrete and real solutions which avoid simplistic and unrealistic false solutions, which calls for governments to be honest about the challenges and opportunities in the global environment, not to oversell the potential of any one bilateral or regional trade deal, but to point out that genuine progress for better trade is in the best interest of our country. It's the approach we'll take in a shortened Labor government. Jason and I and our entire Labor team are looking forward to making the most of these challenges and opportunities on behalf of our country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris, for doing us the favour of giving a really substantive speech containing some good ideas. Chris has kindly said that he'll take questions, and we have about almost 25 minutes for questions. I'm going to kick off with a couple of questions and then I'll go to the audience. So please start to think about your questions. I'm going to ask you a question about politics and then a question about trade, Chris. First of all, on politics. Let me put a similar question to you that I put to the Treasurer, Scott Morrison, when he spoke here from that lectern, indeed, in September. To what extent is the Australian political system vulnerable to the forces of populism and nativism to the same extent that some of our comparable countries are? What are the chances? I mean, you spoke a little bit about how the benefits of open economies are not spread as fairly and widely as they should be. What are the chances of Australia suffering a shock federal election that's anything like the shock election that the United States went through in November?
Well, I think it's an issue we need to be alive to, Michael, of course. I think that we have one very big advantage over like-minded comparable countries, United States, United Kingdom, continental Europe, and that is our 26 years of uninterrupted economic growth. That is our one biggest single advantage in tackling this issue, because we have a story to tell. The point I make in this address is that it's not evenly spread, and we need to be alive to that. We need to be alive to the dislocation in many of our communities, but at least we have the basis of the story. It's a compelling story because it happens to be true that the, in many senses, bipartisan agreement about openness over the last three decades has led to the second longest period of economic uninterrupted economic expansion of a developed country in the history of the world. And that is something which no other country can point to. And indeed, there's a real anger, particularly in the United States, but I think in continental Europe as well, that in the public perception, there was a huge price to be paid in 2008-09, that nobody really paid the price for that apart from ordinary working people, and that the recovery has been anemic. Now, that is not a phenomenon which we have to deal with in Australia, but as has been shown, it's not just about one nation, but there's an isolationist trend in many sort of third parties in Australia, which we need to combat through the evidence battle, the passion battle, and the fairness and inclusivity battle.
One more question on the politics. We spent a lot of time in recent years bemoaning the leadership churn in Australia as one of the defects of the parliamentary system. But one of the defects of the US presidential system is that once somebody is elected, it's very hard to get rid of them. So my question to you is, if you had a figure as prime minister or party leader in the Australian system, whether from one of the major parties or in a different universe, perhaps from a minor party, how do you think such a figure like Donald Trump, for example, would survive in a party leadership system in the parliament, the Australian parliamentary system?
Well, I mean, those comparisons are very difficult because it's simply such a different system. And you point to Donald Trump. I might point to you that Jack Kennedy famously said after the Bay of Pigs, if I was Prime Minister, I'd have to resign. He would have lasted not very long as President under a Westminster system, and he would have had to resign if he was head of a government in a Westminster system after the debacle of the Bay of Pigs. So it's very hard to make those comparisons. I don't think Donald Trump would have got to where he is under a Westminster system. That's the key differential. You've got to argue daily in the bear pit in question time. It can be the quickest hour of your life, or it can be the longest hour of your life, depending on what end of the, whether you're on the giving or receiving end of question time. And it really does lead to a different test for leaders. You get put through your mettle through any Westminster system or comparable system. I'm not suggesting that American leaders don't have to go through a rather onerous process to become their party nominees, but it's a different dynamic.
Of course, we hope that the quickest hour of your life is when you're speaking to the Lowy Institute. Let me ask you a trade question.
I hope
question.
Speech didn't go for an hour.
Let me ask you a trade question. You made an argument for multilateral reform being the best, through the WTO being the best reform process, better than plurilateral options or bilateral FTAs. But you also acknowledged that there's limited bandwidth in political systems to do too much at once. So does that mean you are signalling that a Labor government would de-emphasise bilateral FTAs in order to focus on these other reforms that you think are more important?
Well, I think what Jason and I are saying here is that they are very much the third best option. And if they are the only option in town, well, I understand why we pursued them in government, this government pursues them, we understand that. But the point that we're making today is let's not just assume that they are the only thing that we can get. What we're really doing is peeking our head above the horizon and saying this might seem unrealistic just today, but if anything's been shown over the last 12 to 18 months in international politics, everything's unpredictable. and there will be a natural correction at some point in the international political pendulum, and we want Australia to be ready. So there are some benefit, there are benefits out of bilateral trade agreements, of course. Again, we pursued them in office, and we continue to pursue them where they're in our national interest, but we would also keep a very firm and clear view that they were very much the third best option, and that we wouldn't let them eat up as much of our political body politic, our body politic in our country, as they have done over the last few years.
All right. Now, I'd like to give the audience an opportunity to ask some questions of the Shadow Treasurer. I saw this gentleman over here first.
My name is Freddie Sharp. Chris, a quick question for you. Your platform is built upon two principal building blocks, supporting international trade and the benefits that result, but managing a more equitable distribution of those benefits at a social level. On the second point, why, I wonder, do you have you been so reluctant to engage in the concept of a Buffett tax, particularly when it can be complementary to the other very good measures you're proposing? It's not either or. Isn't it surely and also?
Fred, thanks for the question. Proponents of a Buffett tax are arguing for a more progressive tax system. I agree. In fact, I would argue that Labor has taken to the last election and to the next election the most progressive tax policy that we've had in generations. 50% of tax deductions are negative gearing, for example. 50% of the benefit goes to the top 10% of income earners. It's a highly progressive policy. It's even more stark with capital gains tax concession. 70% of the benefit goes to the top 10% of income earners of capital gains tax. These are things which 2 or 3 years ago would have been, for many people, unthinkable that the alternative government would progress major reforms in this space. They've done it, and I would argue we've won that debate. And we'll continue to argue and fight for that to the next election. But I think it goes to the virtue of careful and methodical examination. I mean, we worked on our capital gains and negative gearing policy for 2 years, considered all the potential unintended consequences, the impact on the economy, etc. Now, a Buffett tax is a very blunt instrument to try and achieve a similar objective. I call it the Buffett tax. It doesn't actually exist anywhere. It's a concept. It's an idea. It's a fine idea, but it doesn't actually exist anywhere. No government has implemented it, and actually no left-wing progressive party in the world currently has it as its formal policy of any comparable country to us. You have to think through the unintended consequences. Now, for example, many charities, universities, philanthropic organisations in Australia frankly rely on contributions from high-income earners. Not a bad thing. Now, you might argue that those high-income earners would continue to donate if it effectively wasn't tax-deductible, but that's a huge risk to take. Similarly, many investors, angel investors in the entrepreneurial sector of our economy are high-income earners. They take a risk, the payoff is substantially great, but the chances of failure are very high, and that has some protection in the tax system. So the better way, in my view, of achieving a more progressive tax system is to carefully identify those tax concessions which are no longer fit for purpose and which benefit high-income earners overwhelmingly, and reform them carefully, methodically, in great detail, rather than just a blanket, one-size-fits-all tax rule, which I think would have very significant ramifications, which might not have been considered by everybody who hears the principle, the idea, and thinks that all sounds very sound and valid, but there are actually very substantial real-world implications of it.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Jess Jennings. Two questions. One is, if in Trump's America a corporate tax cut does come to pass, to what extent does that undermine Malcolm Turnbull's tax cut for Australia, which already has questionable value? And a second question, how easy do you think Pauline Hanson's 2% easy tax on anything and everything would actually be to implement?
Well, the first one, of course, we have to have in mind the competitiveness of our tax system, but the fact is that that investors in Australia consider a whole range of circumstances, a whole range of inputs into their investment decision, of which tax is just one. And in Australia, of course, it sometimes frustrates me that our headline rate is compared to the headline rates of the United States, for example. In the United States, there's state corporate taxes as well, which don't get considered in that headline rate comparison. In Australia, we have dividend imputation, which the United States doesn't have. And dividend imputation means that, in effect, any domestic investor pays no corporate tax, in effect. So all these things need to be considered, and simply the case that when you're having arguments about budget repair, about the need to protect the AAA rating, the need for return to structural budget balance, it's about priorities and choices, and what is a large in terms of its cost to the budget, corporate tax cut, just simply can't be justified. We've just been through the biggest investment boom in our history with a 30% tax rate. Now, I'm not suggesting that that doesn't mean you need to have a view towards ongoing competitiveness, but I am suggesting it means that plenty of people in the right circumstances are prepared to invest in with a 30% corporate tax rate. In relation to the second question, I think it's utterly unworkable.
Not as easy as it sounds, maybe. Jacqueline Magnay. Maley, I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
Jacqueline Maley from the Sydney Morning Herald. Mr Bond, you talked earlier about the dangers of nativist populism, and it seems to me that one of the things that populists do well, or populist leaders do well, is undermine the people's faith in institutions. Isn't that precisely what your party is doing by refusing to accept the decision on penalty rates of the Fair Work Commission? You're not showing much faith in that institution.
No, Jacqueline, I strongly would disagree with your characterisation. I mean, as I referred to in the speech, we've got to show people that there's some benefit in this globalised economic world for all. And if you're working on a Sunday, you are making a sacrifice, which many other people in the workforce don't make, and that should be recognised. I mean, penalty rates came into Australia in 1947, in effect, in very similar form to what they are now. And having just been through more than a quarter of a century of economic growth, are we really suggesting that we can no longer afford to properly compensate people who are making a sacrifice by working on a Sunday? Sunday is still a different day. We are not a seven-day-a-week economy. I fully accept that there's more demand and requirement for more hospitality and other services to be provided, but Sunday is still a different day. It's still the day that family reunions are held, the kids' birthday parties are held, Father's Day and Mother's Day is on, and you are making a bigger contribution by working on a Sunday. It should be recognised and compensated for. My father was a shift worker. He worked almost every Sunday. He worked almost every Christmas Day, almost every Easter Sunday. And when I asked why, as a kid, I was told two reasons, two very good reasons. One, he worked for the NRMA and people needed to have their cars fixed on Sundays just as much. And two, the penalty rates put food on the table. Those two principles apply just as much in 2017 than they applied in 1978. I don't see why workers who got penalty rates all through those years should now say to the next generation of people on Sundays that they no longer deserve it. I haven't even got to the issues about gender equality and intergenerational equity, considering the proportion of females who work on Sundays. We have a gender pay gap in Australia, which is not getting any better. And, of course, gender equity issues, considering many young people work on Sundays as well. So to go to the number of your question, yes, we respect the independence of institutions. We were faced with a choice between our respect for the independence of the industrial umpire or our respect for standing up for the conditions of those who work on Sundays. We chose the latter.
Greg Medcraft in the front row. Greg, if you could just wait for a microphone.
Thanks, Chris. Good speech. I was interested the whole issue of, as part of global markets, markets are global, and you see the benefits of just global markets, and that fragmentation is a real worry. And we do keep coming back to this issue you pointed out, which is people are really questioning that value of that really global trade and finance particularly. I'm just curious, this issue of how you deal with the people who feel they've lost out. And with digitisation, more people will lose out and will lose jobs. New concept of the digital refugee, right? I'm just curious what your view is on, a lot of people are talking about this universal basic income payment. And I was just wondering, I know there has been a paper prepared for the Parliamentary Library recently on it that I was having a look at. Maybe you had a lowy, but I was just curious what your view on this was in terms of, how do you deal with this problem that's not just a problem today, it's a problem that's going to grow. And so that's my question.
Well, thanks, Greg. It's a very good question. I agree with the premise of it about the impact of technology, which is, I haven't referred to it specifically in this speech. I think I referred to it in passing. I've given other speeches where I really focus on the impact of technology on the workforce. And for me, it might sound trite, but it's accurate to say the answer to that is more investment in lifelong learning, education is based on lifelong learning to ensure people have the skills to compete in this world where many of the jobs have disappeared. Those of us who shop at Coles or Woolworths, now many of us use an automatic checkout. That wouldn't have happened 5 years ago. Those of us who are on a plane 3 or 4 days a week, which is several of us in this room, you don't interact with a human being now with your luggage, you put it on a carriage and off it goes. That wouldn't have been the case 2 or 3 years ago. So these jobs are disappearing. There is an impact of technology. But I think it was best put by McAfee and Bryn Olufsen in their work, The Machine Age. There has never been a more important time for governments to invest in education and lifelong learning, and there has never been a worse time to miss out on education and lifelong learning because of this technological change. That is the best response of governments. Now, about a universal basic income, in Australia, I think part of the success, and I would claim a lot of it from my side of politics, but that's neither here nor there in the greater scheme of things, it has had some bipartisan success. Part of the success of our social welfare system is that it is the most targeted social welfare system in the world. We get the biggest bang for buck in terms of poverty alleviation for every dollar spent on social welfare. A universal basic income is a rather large diversion from that, paying, frankly, you know, an annual payment to millionaires. I don't see the benefit of that in terms of dealing with the problems that you identify.
Warwick Smith.
Hi, Chris. Warwick Smith, Tasmanian Progressive Liberal. Rarer than the Tasmanian tiger. Chris, I have two quick questions.
At least your faction reaches unanimous agreement very quickly.
My faction doesn't exist. Chris, good to see you, by the way. I have two questions. The protection around policy to maintain the AAA, what is your view about that? And secondly, foreign investment is extremely important for this country on an ongoing basis. So as Treasurer, what are the qualities and skills you're looking for in a new Foreign Investment Review Board Chair?
The Progressive Tasmanian Liberal, is that what you're implying? That's, I'm only joking. On the first question, I think if I interpret your question correctly, you're asking how important do I think maintaining the AAA rating is. I think it's important. I think it's important. I think there are three reasons why it's important. One, the cost of Commonwealth borrowing goes up. As a progressive reformer, I'd rather spend that money on important social reforms, not paying interest on government debt. So it will go up. It will take time to wash through the system, but it would be a material cost, a material deterioration in our budget position to lose the AAA. Secondly, of course, it then if the sovereign loses its rating, it automatically flows not only to the state AAAs, go, but banks lose their AA, the big four banks lose their AA inevitably. And that, of course, flows through to borrowing costs for the entire economy. And then finally, just while it would be short-term, it would be material, the impact on confidence. You know, AAA rating is important to us as a nation in terms of just the confidence of investors and consumers, and I think it would be a substantial blow. So I think it's important on the list of government priorities. I think it's, you know, it's up there, hence us, while we have our disagreements, engaging in bipartisan fashion across the aisle to get the omnibus, the first omnibus, not the second omnibus savings, the first omnibus savings bill through, negotiated through in good faith by government and opposition. In terms of foreign investment, I agree with you. It is, you know, I'm on the record saying it's important. I support the Foreign Investment Review Board framework. I think it's the right framework in terms of independent advice to the Treasurer of the day. On those rare occasions where a Treasurer has rejected a large foreign investment over the last few decades, I think those treasurers have got them right, with the exception of ADM, which I think was an error. But I think the other ones, it had been worked through the foreign investment review process, and there were good and substantial reasons, but they are very much the exception. I haven't turned my mind and will not turn my mind to the appointments to the Foreign Investment Review Board until in office.
Yes, Renata Caldor.
Chris, with the profits going up for most companies and wage growth static or going backwards, do you see a correlation between the lack of trade unionism within the workplace and these workers not really having a voice at the table?
Yes, I do, Renata. Yes, I do. And I think that's that is partly an Australian phenomenon and partly an international phenomenon. Yes, I do. We now have inequality at 75-year highs. In the United States, inequality was last this high at World War I. So a century's worth of improvements have gone. I regard reducing income inequality as an improvement. I would like to think that most people agree. Now, there are a number of reasons for that improvement, but it is inarguable in my view that at least some of it came from the agitation of trade unions through those middle decades of the 20th century to improve working conditions and to lobby governments to improve social conditions. And the decline of unionism since the 1980s can be correlated with the increase in inequality. So I would argue there's a clear link. You can argue about, you know, just how much of it is, but there's a clear link that the decline of political and industrial influence of trade unions is a factor in the increasing inequality. Now, unions get a bad rap, and I'm not here to defend every decision taken by every union official in Australia over the last 20 years. And people who let down their union let down their members and our movement. But I will defend and promote the role that sensible trade unionism can play in ensuring that more equitable distribution of national income and the role they've played historically and can play in the future.
Chris, I'm going to take the privilege of the last question and ask you about that interesting tidbit that you revealed that a number of years ago you started learning Bahasa Indonesia. Let me ask you...
Don't ask me to answer in Indonesian.
Let me ask you, first of all, why did you choose that particular language rather than Mandarin or Japanese or another Asian language? How easy or difficult have you found it, and what reward have you gained from it? Because it's not easy to learn a language at
our advanced years. No,
in young middle age, I was going to say, but
there's a couple of reasons why I chose Indonesian over and above the other languages. Firstly, it's easier in terms of the alphabet; you don't have to learn thousands of new characters. Having said that, also because what is important, I don't want to understate the importance of Mandarin or the engagement with China for one second, but China already takes up a prominent place in our political discourse. And many people understand the importance of literacy, whether it be language literacy or broader literacy about matters related to China. As Gareth Evans used to say, there are no two countries in the world so close geographically and so different culturally than Australia and Indonesia, so we have to work harder. And the fact that there were more Australian school students studying Indonesian in 1972 than there are in 2017 is a national travesty. And so for both of those reasons, I completely concede that part of the reason was that I thought it would be easier than Mandarin, but more importantly, frankly, I thought it was a very important for me as the alternative treasurer. I've given one speech in Jakarta with some of it being Indonesian, which was, I'd like to think, noticed in Jakarta. And as treasurer, I'd like to go into Jakarta and be able to converse to some degree in their language. But also the message it sends to people considering undertaking language skills at earlier in life, that it's an important national endeavour, was why I chose Indonesia. As I said, Indonesia will be the world's fifth biggest economy by 2050. And we are not thinking about as a nation how we can best engage. I don't like using the words capitalise because it's a partnership, but how we can best engage with each other to lift the level of economic engagement that there should be.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've all learned something new about Chris Bowen today. I was pleased and gratified to learn that you're a fellow graduate of Woolies. I was a trolley boy, which is slightly harder to automate than check out.
I didn't work at Woolies, but I have shopped there.
Okay, right. I think all of us have also seen the breadth of Chris Bowen and his facility, not only in coming and giving a very substantive speech, but dealing very confidently and impressively with a very wide range of questions, which is why he's held in wide regard. So can I ask you to thank the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen.